Our third case for this morning is United States against Harvey Robinson. Ms. Parling.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Brittany Parling. I'm here today with my colleague, Mike Scudder, and we represent the appellant, Harvey Robinson. We took this case by appointment through the Federal Defender's Office, and we also represented Mr. Robinson in the district court proceedings and at his trial. After over 2 days of deliberations, a jury convicted Mr. Robinson of being a felon in possession of a firearm. That conviction should be vacated, Your Honors, for several reasons. First of all, the district court should have granted Mr. Robinson's motion to suppress the firearm, and at the very least should have held a hearing on it. Second, the district court failed to read a very important instruction to the jury regarding Mr. Robinson's prior felony conviction. Third, the court limited our ability to cross-examine key witnesses, and finally abused its discretion when it denied our motion for a mistrial.
Turning to the point that I'm most interested in of what you've covered in your briefs and you just mentioned deals with the limiting instruction. Now, the government points out that the jury did get this instruction in the written instructions that went to it, and even if the district court made a mistake when he thought for 609 reasons, I'm actually mystified by that thinking, but when he chose not to read that last sentence, why wasn't it enough to include the correct instructions in writing?
Well, you're correct that the jury did receive the full instruction in writing. The district court did not read the last sentence of that instruction, which told the jury that they could only consider Mr. Robinson's prior conviction for a very limited purpose, which was to determine whether the government had proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Robinson was a prior convicted felon. And, you know, failing to read that last sentence de-emphasized the last sentence of the instruction. It did not inform the jury orally that they could only...
Sorry for interrupting, but weren't the jurors told to reread the instructions themselves at one point during the deliberations?
Yes, Your Honor, they were. But failing to read that last sentence, which was incredibly important, it suggests that the jury may not have known that they could only consider the conviction for a limited purpose.
Was it argued for any other purpose other than to show the element of possession by a convicted felon?
It was not argued for any other purpose. But still, the jury could have made could have engaged in propensity inferences here, just, you know, by concluding that because Mr. Robinson had been convicted of a prior felony, he may have been guilty of the crime charged here. And by failing to read that important sentence, we really have no way of knowing whether the jury did, in fact, engage in those kinds of inferences.
Counsel, given the judge's comment that he decided not to read that sentence, I guess I was troubled about whether the language of the instructions was actually settled before the instructions were delivered, which is, as I understand it, is required by Rule 30.
Right. The language of the instruction was settled. Both the government and defense agreed to that entire instruction.
Yeah, it's standard.
Right. And what the confusion was about was that there were certain parts of the instruction that were bracketed that dealt with whether Mr. Robinson had decided to testify. At the time the instructions were submitted to the court, Mr. Robinson, there was still a possibility that Mr. Robinson would have testified. And so there were certain parts of the instruction that were bracketed. And so the district court thought the last sentence of the instruction should not have been read because Mr. Robinson didn't testify.
I understand that. I also don't understand the logic, but I understand that he said that. But I guess was there a point at which the trial judge, the prosecutor, and defense counsel agreed this is the final language?
Yes, absolutely, Your Honor. Both of the parties did agree to the language initially, and I can point the court to if you look at our appendix, page 24, it's page 418 of the trial transcript. The court says, "All right, it will be given to the jury," and it asked defense counsel whether. Or is it said, is that the instruction the government wants?
That's after the jury's already gone out, right?
That's correct.
I'm talking about before closings, as 30B requires.
Right. We had a jury instruction conference. That instruction was agreed to by all of the parties, and there was no discussion on it because it was agreed to. And so that's what the court had before it when it was reading the instruction. And I think that's important that both the parties and the court here agreed that the jury should receive the instruction. And once it was determined that the court did not receive the last sentence of the instruction, both parties, both the government and we, agreed that the jury should be brought back in and read this instruction. And the court simply did not do that. And failing to read that sentence prejudiced Mr. Robinson because it essentially put his background at trial here, and it allowed the jury to make an inference that because he was convicted of a prior felony, he committed this crime. And that's just, the risk there is just too much, especially in a case like this.
Your argument, I guess that I was going to suggest that. I take it your backup argument is it was clearly in the jury's mind a pretty close case.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The jury deliberated for over 2 days. This was a pretty simple case involving one issue, whether Mr. Robinson possessed the firearm. And so it's very clear that they were taking a lot of time on this case, and it was very close.
Did Mr. Robinson ever suggest or introduce evidence that the firearm had just been planted by the police officers or gotten to that laundry basket some other way, or did he just say it wasn't mine?
No.
Suggest.
Your Honor, I think at the trial we put forth some serious questions about the conduct of the police officers at that apartment, and questioned their testimony, what they did at the apartment, and also questioned the motives they had for questioning Mr. Robinson about this firearm. And so I think there was a suggestion, at least, that the police may have planted the firearm. There were also some questions before the jury about police manipulation of evidence. There was some evidence that some drugs that were found in the apartment, a very small amount of drugs, were moved around by the police. And so that was absolutely before the jury, and the police officers' motives were before the jury. So taken in all of that context, this was a very important instruction. It was a very important question, and the jury should have received the full instruction. If Your Honors have no further questions on the jury instruction point, I would like to address the motion to suppress the firearm, which should have been granted here, first of all, because the firearm was recovered pursuant to a warrant that lacked probable cause.
Why doesn't Leon save this warrant, even if we were to agree with you about the informant? And I'm not sure about that, since the informant did appear before the state judge.
The informant did appear before the state judge. Leon doesn't save it here because it's clear that failing to corroborate an informant's statements does not establish probable cause.
Wasn't there corroboration at least of face, street name, and location?
There was corroboration. I think the government
bringing those three things together.
Mm-hmm. The police did something here, mm-hmm. but that's never been enough under this court's precedent to amount to sufficient corroboration.
I know. Look, I wrote Miller for our court last year. You've said in your reply brief you've got to overrule that for you to prevail on this, right?
We acknowledge, Your Honor, that Miller is adverse to us. It certainly is. I think it's important to point out, first of all, that that Miller didn't involve false information provided by the informant, and it did not involve an allegation of recklessness on the part of the police, which is what we have here. We have alleged and we argued that the police officer was reckless in including the informant's false statements in the application, and that should also, you know, that also takes
that,
you out of the good
faith. That's
a
label. How does it change in terms of the facts that were presented?
Well, it's just that the court in Miller didn't have that argument before it, and I think it's just another, the recklessness of the police officer is another way to get out of the good faith exception. And as we point out in our briefs, Miller and the good faith exception shouldn't prevent this court from clarifying the legal point that the warrant here lacked probable cause, because you have to evolve the case law on Fourth Amendment and probable cause. And there's never been, there's no decision by this court, the government can't point to any decision, where what the government did here, what the police did here, was sufficient to establish probable cause. There's always been some kind of connection made between the defendant and the location provided by the informant, whether it's by...
I mean, there is some connection in that the informant says it's there, and I guess what you would have liked is for them to have looked up. I guess they would have seen that his grandmother lived there, so there's a connection.
I think that could have been sufficient, Your Honor. They also could have conducted surveillance at the apartment, looked at the cars and traced the plates on the cars parked near the apartment.
These are retail marijuana deals, right?
Right. I think the point is that just they could have done more, and the police have always done more.
Are you saying that good faith requires some other case in which the similar evidence was found to be probable cause for the officers to get the benefit of Leon?
No, I think the good faith exception doesn't apply, because the clearly established case law of that circuit is that insufficient corroboration it does not establish probable cause. And once you have that clearly established law, it can no longer be given the good faith. The good faith exception can no longer apply.
So what would have told the officer who got the warrant here that showing up with the informant before the judge with this information was clearly not probable cause?
Well, it's the fact, Your Honor, that the police did not do enough to independently corroborate the informant's information. And I see that I'm getting into my rebuttal time, but I would like to point out our argument that Mr. Robinson was at least entitled to a hearing on his motion to suppress, because as you'll recall, Judge Hibbler was initially assigned this case and granted a hearing, and unfortunately Judge Hibbler passed away. The case was reassigned to Judge Norgel, and Judge Norgel reversed that ruling, did not allow a hearing on the motion to suppress. And this court's cases make very clear that a district court judge who receives a case from another judge cannot overturn prior rulings unless there's some compelling reason to do so, like a change in the facts or a change in the law. And here there was neither of those things. There was the law had not changed, the facts had not changed. And
does that rule apply to procedural decisions like this as opposed to merits rulings?
I think so, Your Honor, and this was absolutely a decision on the merits, because not only did the district court judge, did Judge Hibbler grant a hearing on the motion to suppress, he also granted a Franks hearing, which is absolutely a ruling on the merits, because you have to make a substantial showing that the police included recklessly included false information in the warrant application. And I would like to reserve the remainder. Thank you.
Mr. Smith?
May it please the Court, I am Assistant U.S. Attorney Dylan Smith for the United States. I'll jump right in and focus on this jury instruction issue.
So what bothers me about this is without that last sentence, it's not even a limiting instruction. I mean, we can get into whether we think anybody ever pays attention to limiting instructions, but our position as taking guidance from the Supreme Court is that they do matter, and without that sentence, it's just a statement you can consider the conviction on the question whether the government proved it's been convicted of a crime. But it's only the last sentence that makes it a limiting instruction. The jury's not told that. Indeed, the jury is told the opposite. The jury is told, both oral and writing, The evidence consists of the testimony, the exhibits, and stipulations. You can draw inferences, and any inferences you make must be reasonable. So the jury's told, oh, you can draw any inferences you want from this.
Right. Well, I think that instruction is something.
But not limiting.
Grant the point, it does not include
it's
the limitation.
It highlights the evidence.
I think it focuses the jury on what this evidence is coming in for.
But juries regularly hear evidence that comes in on point A, and as long as they're not told they shouldn't think of it for point B, they're told, and this jury was, that they're allowed to.
That's fair, Judge, but I think what the case law instructs is you really have to evaluate this in light of the record as a whole.
Yeah, and that doesn't help you because this is a very thin case.
I want to push back on that a little bit, Judge. I will say just on this issue of the instruction, it's more than what the court had in King, where nothing was given limiting or otherwise, and there had been an introduction of three convictions with the conviction specified. Here, the risk of the jury drawing any propensity inference where there's a single conviction, it's not discussed at any length at the trial, the type of conviction is not mentioned. There's nothing to draw a propensity inference from.
Other than that he's a felon.
He's a felon.
I think we'll agree that this is not a case of prosecutors behaving badly here with respect to this evidence.
Yes, we're not.
I appreciate that. Judge Hamilton. Let me push back a little bit on the strength of the case, because I do think this actually was a strong case. And let me say here, you have, and this is a little bit of the problem with the cold record, but let me lay out for you why. You have two separate admissions by the defendant that it's his gun. There are certain details, particularly as to the second admission, that really reinforce the credibility of the officer's testimony.
This is that I bought it down at, that whatever it was, the intersection.
Yes, that's correct, Judge, and the details about that intersection, and the fact that
the police burst in at a very early time of day, if I'm remembering, tons of them, 6, 7, 8 police officers. The gun isn't discovered until the last officer comes. There are no fingerprints on it. There's nothing.
That's all true.
There are a bunch of people there.
That's all true. And where the case got even, I think, worse in some ways from the defendant is once they called defense witnesses. And in addition to the officer's testimony that once the place was secured, he comes in and sees the gun there, which, by the way, was corroborated by the testimony of Officer Elizondo. It was Sergeant Bloss who found it. The defendant's own witness, the defendant's grandmother, when the defense called her, the defense really unraveled at that point in a number of ways. Sergeant Bloss's testimony had been that he called out the gun when he got into the apartment, and this is really as the search is getting underway.
And this gun is supposedly sitting on top of the laundry basket, and all of the other police officers,
on the ground to the side of the door. And one of the things the government was able to argue in closing, I think credibly, is it makes sense because the first officers in are focused on, the people inside getting the premises secure. And this is all, it's not sort of they're filing in several seconds apart. I think the fair inference is, he's testifying he's the last one in, but they're all coming in fairly close in time together. And what he testified was he calls out that he's found a gun in the laundry basket and waits for someone else to come retrieve it. He doesn't pick up the gun himself. The defendant's own witness, the grandmother, said right when he got in there, now, remember, if you read the trial transcript, the grandmother is the person who lets the officers in, and then she's allowed to leave. So early on, she says, yes, that officer, I heard him call out gun. And that, along with some of the photographic evidence, really demolished this effort to paint this as a frame-up job. Because the testimony from the grandmother and the timestamps on the photographs, which are referenced in here, show that the gun was found and being talked about before anyone knew what the results of the search was. And the defendant's theory, as they articulate it, was this was police disappointed about what they had found or what they had not found in the apartment.
Search and they don't find much worth.
Much
about.
Worth. And the evidence was very clear, not contradicted, that gun is right there before any of this. So the whole theory that was really the defense theory.
I don't understand why the timestamps have anything to do with whether one of the police officers dropped it into the laundry basket or not. And the fact that she hears somebody say there's a gun, so somebody says there's a gun.
Well, I think what it has to do with it, Judge Wood, is that at least as this frame-up theory was being spun by the defense, it was the idea that it was in reaction to being disappointed or in reaction to the fact that Mr. Robinson hadn't cooperated. And
it could have just been an insurance policy.
Well, and that's an inference the jury would have had to draw, and frankly, the government was able to stand up, you know, on closing and say that's really a stretch that they walk around with an insurance policy.
Smith. The defense relies on the jury instruction issue on the Third Circuit's decision from many years ago, I think in the 40s, U.S. against Noble, the Ninth Circuit's decision in Guam against Marquez, which both seem to adopt pretty firm rules, holdings that are contrary to what we would have to do here. I didn't see any response from you in your brief to those.
I'm sorry, Judge. I think we did respond on the issue of, and I'm sorry if this is not what you're alluding to, whether this is essentially a structural error that would require reversal and not entail a prejudice analysis. And we do have a footnote in our brief. I could point it to you. But essentially what we point out is that the Supreme Court has held even when an element of the instruction is
That's your Nader footnote.
That's
we
the
know,
Nader
we know
footnote.
All about Nader.
Yeah.
And I think
I was looking for a cite to Noble or Marquez.
I'm sorry. I think we do cite a case citing Marquez, saying that it's not
sorry.
Marquez is no longer plausible in light of the Supreme Court's holding. And I think that's the Parker decision out of the 11th Circuit.
I'm sorry. There it is. Okay.
So we at least hit Marquez, perhaps not the other. And I think the defense, defendant concedes that at this point.
Yeah, but, I mean, the structural errors, that usually comes up in the context of plain error arguments. And here, I mean, you all and the defense put it right in front of the district judge. Plenty of time to correct it. Easy to correct. And I'm just kind of mystified by the explanation as to why it wasn't given.
Right, and I'm not going to stand here and necessarily defend that explanation. I think Judge Norgel was more explaining the thought process of why it didn't come in.
Mistake. I mean, I think you just have to say the district court made a mistake. The only question is whether you can salvage it.
Right. Look, we wouldn't be talking about this now if he had brought the jury back in. But I do think.
Or if he had had the sense to give a limiting instruction to begin with, not a permission to think about instruction.
And that instruction, of course, did go in the written instructions. And I do think in the mix of evaluating the prejudice here, that's something the court can look at. I mean, obviously, instructions are meant to be read to the jury. We don't dispute that. But I think, you know, what you begin with is, all right, let's say this was the instruction without that particular limitation. Even with that, you're going to look at what arguments were made about the defendant's prior felony conviction. What did the jury know about it? And evaluate the harm that's there. And I don't think this court, looking at United States versus King, where it was sort of that error compounded on top of another error, and nevertheless found it harmless for reasons that apply with greater force here, I think it's difficult to say, without overruling King, that that somehow this is a prejudicial error warranting reversal, given the totality of the record.
I'm trying to think if there are any situations in which prior convictions are admissible in any criminal trial without some sort of limiting instruction. I mean, as an element of the offense is in under 922 G1, 609, 404B, they all get instructions because of the propensity danger, right? And every jury I've ever talked to wanted to know, has he done this before?
Well, and in this case, they didn't hear that he had done it before. They heard he had a felony conviction.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And, they understand this is a case. He is charged with being a felon in possession of a weapon. I mean, that's just out there. And there's no reason to really think here that they're going to go with the prohibited inference because there's nothing about prior possession of a gun. In fact, and I don't – the parties didn't argue this. I don't want to make too much of it, but it just shows the way the inferences actually can go in the other direction. The one party that actually did argue something from the conviction that was to the defendant's benefit was the defendant said, hey, this doesn't make any sense because the defendant isn't going to volunteer. I'm sorry, a convicted felon isn't going to volunteer that that's my gun. So, you know, there really was nothing in this record, and either in terms of the arguments that were made, the length this was focused on, the nature of the stipulation, that would suggest looking at the totality of the record here, you have a reversible error. It just doesn't rise to that level in the government's view. If I could move on very briefly to the suppression issue, I'm happy to talk more about the jury instruction. This warrant the warrant application was based on detailed, recent, firsthand observations by an informant who made statements against interest and appeared before the district judge. The level of corroboration was not all that it could have been, clearly. But the case law in this circuit has been for a long time and from the Supreme Court that you evaluate whether there was probable cause for the issuance of the warrant from a totality of the circumstances perspective.
I mean, it would be pretty easy for an informant to go down the street in some neighborhoods in Chicago and say, you know, I bought drugs inside that house, and there'd be some percentage chance that it was true.
There's always some percentage chance, and the reliability of an informant looks to a number of factors. I mean, reliability isn't just about history of providing information or corroboration. And what you have in this warrant here is a level of detail that, frankly, is pretty good.
When he does the ID of Mr. Robinson, also known as Tukey, as opposed to Toki, which was in some of the briefs, was he just given one picture? Was he given a photo array? What happened?
I don't know that there's anything in the record on that. I do think there's a reference in the warrant application to showing photos, plural, from the Chicago Police Department's CLEAR system. But it's clear, I don't think anyone is arguing that the informant here was shown the equivalent of a lineup. If that's the question.
Was that nickname associated with the photograph in some way?
I think the fair reading of the record is that, yes, that the that sort of street name or AKA, if you will, was associated with Mr. Robinson in the Chicago Police Department's database. So I think that is another indicia here. I don't want to make too much of it.
The nickname that the informant knew.
Exactly, Judge Snyder. So, you know, if you look at where these officers are in September 30th of 2010, okay, McIntyre has come out before that says, you know, there's no inevitable requirement of corroboration or a history of reliable information. And taking Miller, I think the warrant application in that case was April of 2008. So there's no dramatic shift in the law of the Fourth Amendment as applied to John Doe warrants between April 2008 and September 2010 that allows you to say, well, Miller somehow doesn't apply to these officers. And this really was, when you look at that level of detail, the drug conversation, the description of a built-in bookcase in the warrant, and the fact that this is a John Doe who does have to go appear in front of the judge and have be, you know, to swear out the warrant, this is actually pretty good on the multi-factor totality of the circumstances test. You know, on the Franks...
Built-in bookcase, such a big deal. That's mentioned in the warrant, and then it disappears from the story altogether.
Well, and actually, the evidence was that the marijuana was... There was a built-in bookshelf in this apartment. That's where the marijuana was recovered from. It's not a huge deal, but our point is, this is, you know, an additional detail beyond what you see in a lot of these warrants to say there were drugs on the table. This sounded like someone who had been in that apartment. Mr. Robinson pulled drugs out of a sock. So I see my time is up.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anything further, Ms. Parling?
I just have a couple of points to make. The first one on the jury instruction point, and I think actually all of our points, is that it's pretty clear that the jury struggled with this case. They had the case for over 2 days, and there just was not overwhelming evidence here against Mr. Robinson. Not only was there a suggestion that the police may have planted the gun here, but there was also, I think, a suggestion that the police, were fabricating the statements that Mr. Robinson had made, and we questioned their motivations in that respect as well. And that was also before the jury. And with respect to King, this case does not have the type of evidence that you had in King. In King, you saw there was the defendant there had the gun. I think it was in his pocket or something like that. The police saw him with the gun, and he ran into a bar, and then the bartender said that he saw him with the gun as well. So nobody here saw Mr. Robinson with the gun. There were four other people in this apartment while the police were searching it, and the gun was found in a completely different room from where Mr. Robinson was. There were no fingerprints on the gun. So it's really hard to say that there was overwhelming evidence, especially in light of the fact that the jury was deliberating for such a long period of time on this case. And so because of that, the district court's error in failing to read that last limiting sentence of the jury instruction was very important, and it prejudiced Mr. Robinson. This was an element of the crime, Mr. Robinson's prior conviction. So, of course, the jury was going to be talking about it back there in the jury room, and they didn't have the full instruction read to them, informing them that they could only consider it for that very limited purpose. With respect to the search warrant, I just wanted to point out the government pointed to United States versus McIntyre, which was decided by this court in 2008. In that case, there was corroboration, and the informant identified the defendant's face out of a photo array. And here there's no indication that there was any kind of a photo lineup done, any kind of multiple photos shown to Mr. Robinson. And for all of these reasons, we'd ask the court to vacate the conviction and remand to the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. The case will be taken under advisement. And also thank you very much, Ms. Parling, and your firm. We appreciate so much your taking the appointment and doing such a fine job for your client. And thanks to the government.